Hello, and welcome to Parenting Matters, real talk from toddlers to teens. I'm your host, Rebecca Walsh, Director of Early Childhood Matters in San Francisco. We're here to answer your parenting questions from the early years through adolescence. We started this podcast to help you raise resilient, confident kids and teens, and to give you practical tools that can increase your confidence, effectiveness, and your joy in parenting. This is Real Talk, where we share multiple strategies because every child is unique, and we always explore what to try when just nothing else seems to be working. So let's get real and let's get to it. If you're anything like me, you may have been raised in a family that didn't talk about periods, that didn't talk about penises and vaginas and all of those types of things that this generation is now so much more comfortable with. And we now know so much about how empowering it is and how safeguarding it is for children to have this body awareness and consciousness. But that doesn't stop it from being really difficult when your child catches you off guard and asks you some questions while you are in the bathroom and on your period, or noticing that you have different body parts than them. It doesn't stop those moments from being tricky. And today we have an amazing guest who is going to break these things down for us, help us to demystify and take away the shame of talking about our bodies, talking about the changes our bodies go through, and even the concept of starting to talk about sex ed in preschool. So I'm very excited to welcome our guest, Konika Wong. Konika co-founded GPS, Girl Power Science, with her daughter to empower girls to navigate growing up with confidence. She is an author, body literacy specialist, and mom on a mission to flip puberty positive and reframe pubertal changes as superpowers. Based in San Francisco, she has been a puberty educator and science teacher for over 20 years. Her popular children's books, One in a Million, a first book about periods, which skyrocketed to number one new release on Amazon within 24 hours of publishing, and How to Tame a Tickle Monster, a first book about body safety, are designed for kids ages 4 and up. Konika is passionate about starting these conversations early and breaking cycles of shame by celebrating growth. So let's get started. All right. Welcome back, everybody, to Parenting Matters. We're really excited to welcome a very special guest with us today, Konika Wong. Thank you so much for joining us on our show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're really excited to have you here. We had a few questions come in from our parents of quite young children asking about how to talk to their kids about some of these topics, whether it was somebody had seen them in the bathroom during their period. Things come up at such a young age. And I think it is so hard as parents because we often, that's exactly when we're caught off guard, right? We may have in our head some like, okay, one day when they're in fifth grade, I have this conversation, I'm going to prepare for it. But then we're caught really off guard when, you know, our 3 or 4 year old asks us a question or, you know, starts to notice that we have different body parts than they do.
Yes, absolutely.
And so that is where I think sometimes as parents, we can be really unprepared. And so when I started to get these questions in, I knew exactly who I wanted on the show. And I'm so glad that you're here with us. And we will go ahead and jump in with some of our questions. And again, just thank you so much for being willing to answer and jump in with us.
My pleasure.
Okay, so the first question is this. My child is 4 and they are noticing that they have different body parts. They're asking, mommy, why don't you have a penis? Those kinds of things. So the first question is really, when should I start having these conversations and how?
It's never too early, and we have teachable moments all around us, whether you are in the bathroom and they're noticing those things. I always like to just take a deep breath because, my family, my background, we didn't talk about any of this stuff. And so when it comes up, if we can just name it, the more we do, the more comfortable we feel, and the easier it gets. And then they're native to these conversations, and it's very healing for us to see how comfortable it can be, with this younger generation.
That's such a good point. And I'm similar. Like, we never talked about these things in my family. In fact, I would like didn't even tell my mom when I got my period because I was just didn't really know what to say or how to say it. And eventually I had to ask her to buy me some pads. But yeah, I that was kind of how she found out, from a shopping list.
Yes, and I was the same way. I mean, I was making the pads out of toilet paper because I was so
Right.
anxious to ask her, and there's only so much you can do that homemade pad situation doesn't work forever. And so, yeah, my mission is just to make it different for, for it started out for my daughter that I wanted it to be different, and then also for my students as well. And when I reversed engineered these conversations, I realized that the earlier we start, the easier it is. Their questions are so easy and innocent to answer early on. And then you're just opening up that door to show you are comfortable and that you are that go-to person that they can come to with anything. So.
I love that point around it almost being healing for us to see how easy it is, right? Because I think, for our parents, it seems so awkward, it seems so uncomfortable. And then when we start having these conversations with our children, we realize, like you said, that, oh wow, it's so approachable, and they're understanding it in this way that I didn't realize it would be so easy to talk about. I remember as a teacher, we always talked about answering the questions that were in front of us and maybe not answering a different question, right? So just like really simply, for the mom who is wondering about how to answer, a question about different body parts, like how would you answer that just in the most simple
Well,
way?
I always have kind of a three-step process in my head. It starts just that I take a deep breath because kids can really sense our comfort level with things. And so that it just allows me to relax and have a comfortable tone. And then I always like to really make sure that I clarify the question. So usually what gives me a little bit more context and buys me time for maybe a second breath there is just to say, oh, that is a great question. What made you ask that? And that gives me, context. There's a funny story about a little kid that asked, Grandma, what's it called when somebody sleeps like on top of another person's body? And she went into the whole birds and the bees talk. And then the child looked confused and he was actually ready to go to summer camp and he was thinking about bunk beds. And
I love
so,
that.
when you ask the context, it just really allows you. And then here's the third piece to this. So we took the deep breath. We said, wonderful question. What made you ask that? So that we get some context in our head of where, what they saw or what sparked it. So, and then the third piece is just to keep it really short. Pause and check in because they are so curious, and this is what I love about preschool. They're filled with so many questions. So you answer just a teeny short, tease of an answer, pause and see like what is their next follow-up question. That
Oh
way
my
you're
gosh, I
driving the
love that.
conversation, age appropriately and developmentally into what they're curious about. And they're also satisfied that, because otherwise they start to tune us out if we go into this whole very scientific, long, dry explanation, as grown-ups, a lot of us do. So keeping it really, really short. I grew up in a generation where we talked about the talk and we imagined this like sit down, full eye contact, long conversation. But now we know better, and we know about attention spans, and that we have a million opportunities to continue these conversations. So keeping it short allows them to know that they want to keep asking you. So yes.
Yes, I love that. And it is, that I think is the goal of these early discussions, that we become a sounding board for our children, that they know that we're not super uncomfortable, that we're not like, if we were to respond, oh, I don't know. Let's talk about that later or something, right? Like that gives
Yes.
off this, okay, mom's uncomfortable when I ask her why I have a penis and she doesn't, and so that is a very different message than just saying, oh, like I love,
Yes.
taking the deep breath, saying, oh, what makes you wonder about this? Oh, I, yesterday when, we were in the shower or whatever it was.
Yes. And also, if you want, you can also buy yourself time and just say, because oftentimes these questions happen when you're dropping them off to soccer or to school and you don't have enough time to really get into it, or you're a bit distracted, you're driving, or, and so it's also perfectly fine to say, this is such a wonderful question. I'd love to honor it by, at when we have some more time, let's talk about it more. Or I know the perfect book that would explain this so well, and it has pictures to go along with it. Let's grab that book from the library. And so, that so that you can give them that undivided attention, and also possibly just get the narrative that, makes it a lot easier to have the conversation. So, yeah.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so can we practice this a little bit with a question that I actually got a lot as a teacher,
Yes.
because when I started teaching here in San Francisco, I was pregnant with my first child 15 years ago, and I remember the kids would ask, how did the baby get in your tummy? And I remember as a teacher going, oh my gosh, like, how do I answer that? But I kind of followed this rule of thumb of like, okay, let's answer the question that's before you, and then giving more information as it's needed. But yeah, so if, I mean, I guess in that case, it would be pretty obvious why they were asking.
But it's nice to hear their voice. Like they might say, my teacher's, got a baby in her tummy. And then that makes it comfortable, right? But
Yeah, that's true. So it would be, how did the baby get in your tummy?
okay, I'm going to start just by taking my deep breath. That's a great question. What sparked your interest in that? Or, what sparked that question?
Because my teacher has a baby in her tummy, and I don't know how the baby got in there.
Yeah, that's great. So there are so many ways actually that like babies can end up. First of all, the part we have a very special part in our body that helps to grow that baby, and it's actually not our tummy. When we eat our food goes into our tummy, but we have a separate part that's called our uterus. And our uterus is actually the strongest muscle in our body, and it's really stretchy and it can grow when that baby is in there. And there's two special ingredients that come together to make a baby. One is an egg, and I know we're not chickens, but we have eggs. And the other ingredient is a sperm, and there's lots of ways those two ingredients can come together. And then I need to follow my thing of keeping it short. I probably should have kept it even shorter than what I just said.
No, but I love that. I mean, it's kind of answering the question in front of you, and also doing some of that body literacy there, right? Like, I love that you added in that piece of like the uterus is like strong and powerful. And that positive, and I know that's you're so passionate about that in the work that you do. And maybe you could kind of share a little bit more about like how you talk about puberty in this positive way, as well, because we do have another question, around, oh, in my family, periods were a curse for women, and there was so much talk about how awful PMS was. How do I paint a more positive view for my daughter? And
Yes.
so, when you said that around like the uterus being strong. It reminded me of, all the work that you do to create this more positive, you call it flipping puberty positive,
Yes,
right?
exactly. Yes. So the teachable moments could be as simple as if you have a menstruator living in your household, then getting a really aesthetically cute box that stores your tampons and your pads, and it's not hidden away. It's somewhere where, it's going to spark that curiosity naturally.
That's cool.
And yeah, and then, you start those conversations. But you know what? Even if you don't have a menstruator in your household, you can still have that and say it's for guests and still get into that conversation. And along with that, then of course, that leads to like, what is it for? What are these pads or tampons for? And, in my kids' book, One in a Million, it's about periods and it's for ages 4 and up. So it's a very simplified narrative to describe like what menstruation is.
Can I just stop you and say
Yes,
how much
please.
I love that you have a book about periods for ages 4 and up? And I mean, is this the first book that
Yes.
for this age that's been published?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And what I mean, what how did it start? Like how did you get inspired to do it so young? Because I totally agree that it's so crucial to have these
Yeah.
conversations. I think there's still so much taboo around it. And like you said, that shame. And I such a great example, just like having those, pads or tampons out in the open.
Yeah.
But yeah, how tell us a little bit more about the
Yeah, I
inspiration for that.
mean, so in all my puberty classes, there are often parents that have like a preschooler and then they might have like a third grader, a girl. They're worried about, when is her first period coming? In so many of them, the parents say, I wish I knew this earlier. And that just got me thinking, just like all of these conversations with naming our, genitals with accurate scientific names. Equally, why not start this conversation about periods from the first time, they have a question about it when they see us in the bathroom or they see us buying pads or something like that. So, this is the same in the book. It's the same narrative that I've used with my second and third grade students. And with adding the pictures, it's simplified enough that it works for 4-year-olds. The unexpected thing is that parents are saying they're really enjoying sharing it with all genders, like that, little boys are just as interested and curious. And another surprising aspect of writing a book like this for 4-year-olds is that a lot of dads are saying this narrative feels comfortable to them. And so, I mean, essentially what in the book it is we talk about that we what so we have eggs that were born with 1 million, about 1 million eggs in our bodies. And that one day you'll release your first egg. So, yes, if you have a uterus, you're born with these eggs, 1 million eggs, and one day you will release one. And from then on, your body builds a nest and releases that nest once a month. And then I really wanted to take the squeamishness out of this idea of blood. And so there are 3 or 4 clues that lead us to guessing what this nest is made out of. And, I just tell them that, it's probably not like a bird's nest, that's growing inside our uterus, inside our body. So, and one of the clues is just, and actually it's an invitation for parents to take that deep breath. It's like, take a deep breath and this substance that the nest is made out of, it sends oxygen to our whole body. And so that's one of the things it does. Another clue is that it sends nutrients to our whole body. So when we're eating foods, thanks to this,
Right. This actually, before you go any further, this leads to one of our other questions that I want to jump in with, because I feel like this is going to be a perfect answer to this next question that we had, which was, my son has seen me in the bathroom when I'm on my period and asked if I was hurt, and I didn't know how to respond. He is 3 years old.
Yes, that is the perfect question to tie into these clues. So we now know that we have this like nest that forms in our body and that it's released once a month. And if we go directly next to saying it's made out of blood, then, and which we can, now in the book, I have the clues that leads up to it. If we go directly, oftentimes the first thing people wonder is, does it hurt? That's the most common question. I have this curiosity box in my classroom. And the most common question you get around periods is, does it hurt? And so if we can start talking about blood and maybe even like showing examples of when we experience blood, that's not when we're hurt. So when we when we're talking about preschoolers, literally probably the only time they experience blood is when they're cut. You know, they have an owie or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But also, you know, sometimes they might have like a nosebleed and that actually doesn't hurt. Or another one that kids can, since I'm having these conversations with younger and younger kids, another one that they bring up is when they lose a tooth. You know, and what a celebration that is too. And so that blood is not always, that blood keeps us alive, that it's flowing through our bodies. Sometimes like if our foot falls asleep or something, then we realize like, oh, we had cut off the blood circulation in that one area. And so we can think of blood as just this very important, I talk about having an attitude of gratitude, this very important thing that's keeping our bodies alive. So,
I love that because honestly, I've never thought of those examples before. And I've myself been confused. How do you explain blood? It doesn't hurt. But I love the examples of, you know, the nose or the tooth.
I mean, just in general, you know, like that it's in our bodies sending oxygen through our whole body.
Yeah.
That when we're eating food, it's the blood that's taking all the vitamin C and all the vitamins to the rest of our body.
Right. And creating this like positive association, right? The same thing that, you know, you're thinking about with, you know, the uterus being such a powerful organ, you know, the strongest muscle. I had no idea that was true, by the way. But I love that, just creating this positivity around around these things. And I think whether you have a boy or whether you have a girl, obviously for a girl, how empowering this can be, right? To think of these things as something that's life-giving, that's bringing energy, but even, you know, also firmly, and I have two boys and a girl, right? And I firmly believe that in raising boys to understand women in and menstruation in a positive, empowering light is so important for for boys and the men that they'll become as well.
Yes. The first time I read the book was actually, even though it's for ages four and up, it was for a group of sixth graders in Singapore. The teacher that asked me to read it, she worked with her here in San Francisco, and then she moved to be a teacher in Singapore. Huh? And she said that the topic of menstruation is even more stigmatized in the culture there. But the first person to raise their hand was a boy, a sixth grade boy. And he said, "Do you mean I wouldn't be here on this planet if it weren't for periods?" And I said, exactly. So I just, you want, if we can, right? If we want that, we can make the meaning something like larger than ourselves. And then we're not fixated so much on the management. And I left like the management piece, the pads and the tampons out of it intentionally, just for it to be this short introductory, you know, concept. It's not relevant to a 3 or 4 year old, like how to use a tampon.
Right.
And so we just kept it simple, which is this premise of, you know, the eggs. And
Oh my gosh, that is such a powerful story. Just this idea of raising a generation of children that can see puberty, that can see, you know, menstruation as this positive, life-giving energy, right?
Yes, exactly.
And it kind of goes back to that question about the mom writing in about how it was such a negative thing in her family and wanting to, you know, create a more positive, even though we may recognize, see, it was actually the opposite in my family. Like my mom never talked about it. And if somebody, like I had a friend whose mom would say, "Oh, I have PMS or cramps." And my mom almost like, "Oh, that's just made up." Right. Like she didn't even like believe it to be true. And maybe she didn't experience the symptoms as much herself because I think every woman is a little different with that, but it was still like sort of a negative message to me that, you know, it wasn't even something that you should talk about or something that you should acknowledge. So yeah, how would you talk about some of those? Like if you are getting a headache, I mean, is that something you shared with your daughter, like before she started her period, like that?
So, it's an interesting thing. I go back and forth with that. So, in my period workshops, I have not necessarily included information about PMS and cramps. Although the narrative, when you have a class of 12 students in the curiosity box, they've heard about it. And I'm never going to ignore a question like that. And so it generally ends up getting answered through that, but I didn't incorporate it. And there's a, I mean, one reason is that going back to that less is more, that when they're coming to a workshop, or these first conversations we're talking about, that we don't really need to share like a long, long, long narrative. That's one of the reasons. A second one is actually that just describing just what I said about the nest and the blood is like more than enough information, I feel like. And like you said, not everyone experiences cramps or headaches or other PMS symptoms. And so we can address those. The first periods are often anovulatory, meaning that you don't release an egg. And oftentimes there are no cramps associated with the very first period. That being said, when I do get questions about them, I want to just continue my very neutral tone of explaining without having negativity, which kind of goes back to this question, right? With all of the stuff, if we can maintain as neutral of a tone, ideally, I mean, we want to be honest too, and they have like a radar of when we're not being truthful. And also we know that our bodies, our human bodies have suffering. There are things that are uncomfortable and that we are going to narrate that and not hide that. With cramps, I just getting back to the uterus being the strongest muscle in our body. And kids can usually, they can relate to cramps like when you eat too fast and then maybe you try to go swimming or you run and then you get kind of a stitch in your side. So I tell them similarly, when your body is getting rid of that nest, it's kind of a big job and the muscles really need to work hard. And so sometimes we'll feel some cramping with that. Cramps, actually, and this is that a lot of the adult women that are in with their kids at the workshops are surprised to hear. But while cramps are really common, they're not actually normal. I know that's like a weird, two different, like the wording of it, but ideally they're preventable and not for all women. Of course, we know all bodies are different, but through nutrition, I mean, with my daughter, we just increase the amount of magnesium in her diet right before she has her period. And for both my daughter and I, the more I've learned through this work that I'm doing more recently, I'm finding that even the worst cramps can be preventable. Even with my perimenopause cramps, that actually I have much heavier periods and worse cramps, dietary changes and lifestyle changes can actually have a dramatic positive impact on preventing it. So that's that's a long answer, but why I don't necessarily go right to something like explaining cramps along with the conversation about periods, if that makes sense. It's nuanced, there's yeah.
Well, and I think one of your goals is to start with this positive narrative, right?
Exactly.
And really emphasizing like how amazing our bodies are that they can
Exactly.
do this and like what potential that gives us. And
Yes.
so I think that's usually where you start, right?
Yes,
And
exactly.
do you find that like that parents are pretty surprised in general by that more positive version?
They are so surprised. Like if they're not. Well, so when they're reading this book, they're like so pleasantly surprised at how easy it was to just, especially the younger they start, it's just, and or if their child just did the workshop and then they're leaving, they're just like emailing me like I was like red in the face and looking down when, I heard about this and this is such a different paradigm shift. And there's definitely an impact I can always sense of what narratives they're coming to me with. And I get a lot of, kids that are just like, my mom says this is the worst thing ever, and then I have to, it's a little more work for me to try to spin it positive because they are from their own mom, they've already have a preconceived, notion.
Yeah.
But
So if yeah, and so if you if you were experiencing those things as a mom, like, do you have ways that you encourage parents to talk about those things that can spin it more positively? Like, I mean, I guess just explaining, like you said, maybe like, oh, I'm having some cramps in my uterus because, the nest is trying to shed, and the uterus is such a powerful muscle, and so it's working really hard. Or I don't know if there's other ways that
I mean, I
you.
think maybe even just like neutralizing like all the times that our bodies don't feel great, right? I'm sure they hear us like complaining about our back hurting and all that stuff. So maybe like intentionally trying to make sure just we're not putting more weight from the lens that society has given us of periods being this like just terrible thing. We like, my generation is skewed towards that negative lens. So if we can neutralize it just like anything, we get headaches, we get backaches, sometimes we get a belly ache, right? And it's just one of those things. And then maybe it's like our reaction to it that we can model, which is such a powerful thing just to model that I need rest. I'm gonna rest. I'm gonna listen to my body. It needs rest now. We know
Oh, I love
in our
that.
luteal phase before our period that if we really are living cyclically, that we give our bodies rest. We drink more water, hot tea, blankets, reading a book. Let's just
Oh, I
model
love that.
that,
I
right?
love that.
And what a positive spin that is. I mean, here it's something like cramps, but we're spinning at putting up those boundaries, those healthy boundaries. If this is a time where I'm gonna read a book, and I hear of families, with
I love
sons
that.
and daughters that know about this because they talk so openly that they'll bring the breakfast in bed to their mom because they know like this is a time when, she needs rest.
I love that. And it almost like creating some built-in self-care rituals around the menstruation instead of it being something I have to suffer through. It's like, ooh, it's something I can look forward to as, getting breakfast in bed or just having some more cozy time on the couch or something.
My daughter and I, we bake brownies, but I could
Oh,
have
yes.
started that when she was a preschooler and then she would know and what a positive association she'd have. Like, oh, my period's coming up. I'm going to
Yeah.
bake some
Oh,
brownies. And like,
I
what a
love that.
normalized way to just talk about it. My body needs
Yes.
chocolate right now. It has magnesium and it helps with cramps.
That's awesome. Yes, that would be a great little ritual to start at any age. Okay, so the next question is really around body literacy and something else that I know you're really passionate about around helping children to have healthy boundaries. And I know your second book, How to Tame a Tickle Monster, is really around these goals of giving children agency in their own bodies. So maybe this could be a question you could answer. It's I heard that using correct anatomical names for penis, vagina, vulva, etc., can protect against abuse, but my husband is really uncomfortable with these terms. Any advice?
I mean, with my own husband, there is a yin and yang. Like with things that I'm comfortable with, often he's uncomfortable and vice versa. So I think like we fill in. Above all, we want to be comfortable with what we're saying because kids have a radar and it's better to use the language that is comfortable. My family is from India, and just from a cultural perspective, like we used the Indian words, that are clearly very different than vulva and penis, the Bengali words. And so whatever comes comfortably, I think the most important thing is naming, giving a name, right? We don't want to, and that's the empowerment piece, that prevents that abuse, is that they know that just like we have an elbow and, and we have a brain and a nose and a mouth and, with my preschoolers, sometimes we even sing like head, shoulders, knees and vulva, knees and vulva,
Oh my gosh.
and
I can imagine.
and we're just getting lots of giggles out, which is great. In the Tickle Monster book, I do actually also acknowledge this piece that kind of ties into this question, which is listening to our bodies when we say penis or vulva. That and in the book, the character gets really flushed because they're very embarrassed. That actually to listen to our bodies and that reaction is protecting ourselves. And so to thank our bodies for that. And if we ever feel that in outside of the context of hearing the word penis and vulva in this kid's book, to listen to that. And I think that that's a really good spin because, you know, in my classes, when we talk about this stuff, inherently I get nervous laughter. And we talk about what nervous laughter is, that it's not my students being disrespectful. It's just that their bodies are feeling uncomfortable. And it's usually like this perfect teachable moment when there's nervous laughter when we say those words, that, you know, we can just say our bodies are protecting us. These are really sensitive parts of our bodies. These are, you know, parts of our body that are hidden behind our clothes. So we don't see them very often. We see them, you know, when we take a shower or a bath or when we use the toilet. But, you know, explaining and normalizing that, it works as a teachable moment. So, and pushing through, you know, being vulnerable with our kids can be so powerful. So like with my daughter, if something's uncomfortable for me, then I'll narrate that and say, my parents didn't talk about this. So this is really uncomfortable for me. And then, you know, it's just showing that I'm trying my best, but that, and also actually normalizing that in our culture or in our society, these aren't like dinner table conversations. Like we're not just going to say pass the peas and by the way, my penis. And even preschoolers get it, you know, that the, that we're not like, we talk about potty talk with preschoolers. And it's that fine line of that balance, right? Of being really comfortable sharing about our bodies, but also knowing there are some topics, that, you know, I mean,
aren't appropriate in different scenarios, right?
Exactly.
And with different people, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think that is important to communicate to children around those kinds of boundaries as well. And why, you know, why do we not go outside naked, or, you know, and explaining to them that this is something that we do cover in our public lives, because this is something that is, do you use the word private part? What is your,
So, I use middle parts. And the reason is that, I say that our whole body from our head to our toes is private. And the more you realize, like, why not just explain that we have boundaries in our whole body? And actually what goes even beyond that, in the book, I talk about our personal space bubble, that when someone invades your personal space bubble, it can even be like the tone of voice that they use or the way they're looking at you. And so what we're really trying to do is get away from the narrative, the old school narrative about stranger danger, and instead empower that intuition, that trusting our gut that something's off, and that you'll never get in trouble if you sense that something, you know, is off and you have that uncomfortable feeling, and that it's always helpful to talk to your trusted grown-up about any of this stuff. So, but you know, private parts, those are definitely a commonly used term. So when I talk about middle parts, I say, and some people call them private parts, and they are private. Our whole body is private. So it's not like a wrong term to use. It's correct. And we, again, want to just use what comes out most comfortably.
I guess as far as maybe going into a little bit more detail around like, why is it important to name those parts for our children, and how does that protect them from abuse, I think is a common question I know I've gotten before.
Yes. I mean, I think it just is a direct correlation to their confidence, A, and B, that we've talked about that these are personal and private parts, including all the other parts too, but that when someone who's trying to groom or someone who might be a predator sees that a child knows these names, then they inherently know that they are educated, that they are having these conversations comfortably with their trusted grown-ups. And it's probably a red flag to them, a warning that they're going to have the words to be able to speak up about it. Because all too often it's that silence, because it can be very, very confusing. And so if we arm them from these young ages, as young as three or four, the understanding that they should listen to their body, trust their body when they feel uncomfortable, and tell a trusted grown up, Then in that moment of confusion, it'll still be very confusing because it just is. All we need is for them to speak up about it. And if they have the words, they're more likely.
And if they knew that their parent was comfortable enough to name those parts for them, that they those parts were given a name, they were, they were called, they were told that was their penis, that was their vulva, that was their vagina. And so they know that, okay, this is something, even though this isn't a part that is, like you said, always out in the open, that is, it is a part that isn't seen as much, or it is, they kind of inherently know that it's sort of a covered part, but they know that mom or dad is comfortable, that they've named it for me, that they, these are parts that I can talk about, right? But yeah, but also that added layer of sending a message to the predator, because we know that sexual abuse is usually not this random occurrence, right? It's somebody that is slowly grooming, usually somebody that the family knows, or that the child has ongoing contact with, right? And it's a grooming process. It's, hardly ever at this age some, random occurrence with a stranger. So in that process, it sends a very strong message to somebody that this child is confident that they're talking to their parents. They seem to know, and that's really important
Yes,
for sure.
absolutely. We just want them to be comfortable coming to us.
Yeah, cool. Well, gosh, I feel like we covered so much around body autonomy and safety, but also on how to begin to flip this narrative of positive puberty and to see this as something that we can embrace and really celebrate, right?
Yes, exactly. Our bodies are always changing, and we're just grateful when they're healthy and growing.
Awesome. Thank you so much for this. This was so wonderful. If people do want to find out more, what is the best way for them to learn more from you, Hanukkah?
You can find us on Instagram at Girl Power Science, as well as our website is girlpowerscience.com. And we do work with all genders as well. So, yes.
Awesome. And your books, if you want to just give us
Oh,
the names of your books, we'll
yes.
definitely put the books in the
Absolutely.
show notes as well.
Yes. So
But
there's One in a Million, a first book about periods for ages 4 and up. And then How to Tame a Tickle Monster, a first book about body safety.
amazing. Yes, thank you so much. We'll put all of those links in our show notes. And thank you so much again for tackling, sometimes these taboo questions, and you always answer them with such confidence and grace. And I think really empower parents as they're listening to be able to respond. I know every time I hear you, I'm like more inspired to talk to my children in this way that is just so more matter of fact and positive, right? And so thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to Parenting Matters, real talk from toddlers to teens, where your personal parenting journey matters and your questions are always welcome. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, we'd love it if you'd like, subscribe, leave a rating and review, and share this podcast with a friend. It really helps others find us and supports the work we are doing to support parents near and far. Check out the show notes, leave your parenting questions in the comments, or head to our dedicated webpage, earlychildhoodmatters.org/podcast. There you can find even more resources and ways to stay connected. If you like our podcast, check out our full list of in-person classes and support groups in San Francisco and on-demand parenting classes on our site. Use code ParentingMatters15, all caps, for 15% off. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram to stay in the loop. Shout out to my teenager Joey for continuing to follow his passions in piano and music production and for creating the music for this podcast.